This is Alicia, and welcome to the College Life Podcast. The College Life Podcast is here to provide you with ideas on how college students can design their life, be mindful and intentional about what they're doing while they're in college. We will also interview people who have already graduated from college, who currently work at a college, and current college students. Each guest will share their story, their struggles, their successes, and offer you tips on how to take ownership and make the most of your time while you're in college. Let's get to it. Welcome to the College Life Podcast. It's Alicia here, and I just wanted to tell you thank you so much for supporting and downloading the podcast and listening. It's been such an amazing experience for me, and we just hit 1,000 downloads, and I really just can't even believe it. So I just wanted to say from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for supporting this. If this is your first time listening, welcome. I am so glad that you are here. In this episode, we interview Dr. Michael Kimball, who is a professor at University of Northern Colorado and the author of the book Ethnowise, Embracing Culture Shock to Build Resilience, Responsiveness, and Connection. We talked about so many incredible things, and I can't wait for you to listen to it. We're going to be talking about really experiencing culture and how do you do that? How do you experience culture? We're going to talk about culture shock. We talk about how to get involved in the National Park Service. There's an internships available. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about mindfulness and how to really, again, immerse yourself in a new experiences and enjoy the process instead of experiencing that discomfort or just really understanding what that discomfort means. I also want to mention that we will be doing weekly episodes this fall semester. I'm a little nervous to tell you this because that means I have to do it, and I'm going to try my hardest to make sure that I am uploading an episode every single week for you. I really want this to be a place where you can come and get inspiration, ideas on how to make the most of your experience in college. We're going to go ahead and get right into this episode, and thank you again so much for being here. Welcome to the College Life Podcast. Today I have with me Dr. Michael Kimball, and he is going to be sharing a little bit about his book. So Dr. Kimball, why don't you just introduce yourself and talk a little bit about your journey to where you're currently working now?
Sure. Yes. Well, I've been at UNC now for something like 11 years. I teach in the anthropology department, and I conduct different kinds of research. One of those types of research has to do with my original field, which was archaeology. That's what I was specially trained in. And so I've done archaeological research in different parts of the world. Ireland is one place, and I've also done some work in Denmark, and done a little bit of different kinds of archaeological work elsewhere. So my work has gotten into what I call heritage studies, which means when you look at where your history comes from, your own cultural heritage, your understanding of who you are, draws a lot from your origin stories as a human being, in terms of your ancestors and in terms of the nations and cultures and ethnic groups that you descend from. And so I've been exploring how we understand heritage, how we create it, and how we make sense out of it, and what it looks like, and what it feels like, and how we react to it. So that's one area of work that I've been doing. And also, I've been working on cultural anthropology. I've been teaching cultural anthropology for probably 20 years. And I came to discover that while it's a fascinating field, the way that it's often taught is for students who want to be anthropologists or might become anthropologists, but there's a lot of other students out there who could benefit from the different perspectives and even the methods of anthropology. And when you're only teaching to people who might become majors or might become even professional anthropologists, you kind of lose a little bit of that benefit, because you know the focus is on specific concepts and laundry lists of terms and histories and things like that. And that can turn people off a little bit if they're not really motivated to dive into the field. So I discovered that really students love any kind of study when they see its relevance, when they understand how it's relevant to them and to their lives. And I realized pretty early on that the way that it's often taught, that relevance isn't always in the forefront. And so I thought it would make a lot more sense to have students discover anthropology as a set of tools and perspectives and skills that allow them to make more sense out of their own life, to make more meaning out of their own life, and to benefit from it in terms of their careers and in terms of their interpersonal relationships and things like that. So I was working on that for quite a while, experimenting in my, you know, I have, you could put it this way, I have every semester about 65 guinea pigs in a room, and I try out different things to see what resonates, what sticks and what doesn't. And so for 20 years, I've been playing around with that, conducting those experiments. And so far, all the guinea pigs have survived, and they were all treated humanely. I want to point that out. And at the same time, though, I learned quite a bit, and I hope they did too, about how to make anthropology more relevant to us as human beings. And as in some psychologists call this group emerging adults, people who are between the ages of 18 and say 29, who are in a very exciting part of their life where they're trying to make a sense of who they are and trying to discover their direction in life. So that was really a major thrust of how I was developing my classes. And so as a result, after 20 years of playing around with it, I decided it was time to write a book. So that's how the book fits into the whole thing.
Yeah, so I would be curious, just because there are a lot of current college students who are listening, do you remember a moment or do you have a story of when you thought, I need to do this for a living?
Anthropology for a living.
Either anthropology or even connecting with the book too, either
one. Oh, connecting with the book, yeah. Oh, yeah. I've always, maybe I'll go off on a few different tangents in answer to that question. Because for me, anthropology and archaeology, which archaeology is a study of our ancestors, both recent ancestors and even deep ancestors that back to the beginning of being human, but also it's the study of the things we left behind. So some people, when they're a little jaded about it, say it's basically the study of garbage, because it really is looking at the things we leave behind that we don't think of much anymore, leave in a place that we were, whether it's a building or a knife or a fire pit or an entire city. You know, these are things that fascinate archaeologists and help us understand our past. So I've been interested in that for a very long time, ever since I was a kid. And this shows up in my book too. This is a story that shows up in my book about the work that I did originally as a 16, 17-year-old. I decided I wanted to do something different in the summer rather than just working. So I joined something called the Student Conservation Association, and which is open to kids, high school students, and also college students. There's different programs. It's still going. I ran into some SCA people recently, and I was very delighted to find out that the organization is still there. Works directly with the National Park Service and gives kids and young adults and emerging adults and this opportunity to do some fascinating different kinds of things in national parks. It's voluntary. You're not paid for it, but you are housed and given all kinds of really cool opportunities. And it does give you a foot in the door if you're interested in working for the Park Service down the road. So when I was 16 or 17, I went to Mesa Verde National Park, which coincidentally is here in Colorado. And I was growing up in Massachusetts, so I'd never been to Colorado before. I went out there for a full summer. And it wasn't, Mesa Verde, for those who don't know, it is one of the few, if only, archaeological national parks in the country. Most national parks are, you know, built around the natural features of the landscape and wildlife and things like that. But this one is built specifically around the archaeological remains of the ancestral Puebloan people who lived there thousands of years ago and abandoned that area about 700 years ago. So what's left is incredible, what they call them, cliff dwellings and mesa top dwellings of people with, you know, everything from human burials to agricultural remains. They were farming people. They grew corn, squash, and beans, and artifacts left over, and clothing, everything has been, you know, discovered in through specific excavations that have happened in Mesa Verde National Park, and it's all preserved, and some of it is on display for visitors. And so I was super excited about doing that. But I wasn't out there to do it for that reason. I was out there to help build a fence line in the back country of Mesa Verde National Park. And this is an area where visitors are not allowed to go. And so that was kind of cool. And we lived in tents. And we built a fence line because the very right next to the park was the Ute Mountain Ute Reservation. And they also have a tremendous archaeological heritage there. And they also take people on tours. So if you're interested in seeing the Native American perspective, that's pretty amazing. But they had ponies that lived there and were basically wild running around and coming into the park area and eating fragile, rare vegetation that the charter for the National Park Service includes, you know, protecting. So the Park Service decided to build a fence line, which was, I don't know if that was a good idea or not, but there we were, you know, pounding metal rods into the ground and stringing them with wire. And we did that for weeks. And in the book, I mentioned that, you know, one night, it was an evening, we were sitting around a campfire and everybody was just, you know, eating dinner or whatever, finishing dinner. And it was twilight and I just stood up and I looked just at the landscape and felt pulled into the shadows, really, around the campfire. And I just started walking and I left the group and I kept feeling pulled. And I'm not saying this is some kind of necessarily a spiritual thing, but it was a whole body thing. It was a holistic experience of smelling and feeling and thinking. And so I just walked, followed a dry wash, an area that in the heavy rains would turn into a short-term little river. And so I followed it right to the edge of a cliff. And I just felt this feeling of incredible connection to the landscape. And I got down on my hands and knees and I looked over the lip of that precipice. And right beneath me was a Puebloan structure that had been built, you know, 1,000 years ago. And I didn't know anything about archaeology at that time. I was just a kid going to high school, summer job, volunteering in the National Park Service. I had no idea. But I had seen bits of pottery, you know, lying around in the landscape, some chert that looked like it had been a tool or something like that. So I'd seen things and I didn't understand it very well, but I knew it was out there. But that evening was the most powerful sensation of being connected to the past that I had ever had. And I was looking at it was probably a storage building designed for storing grain and things like that. And all of a sudden the whole place just came together for me. And that's one of the kind of seeds that were planted for me in my youth that ultimately blossomed into fascination with archaeology and an interest in doing archaeological research and things like that. That's connected. It's connected to the book. I mean, there's that story in the book, but also there's this sense that I had. And over time, as I was teaching anthropology, I realized I needed to communicate to my students that our experience of culture, whether it's ancient culture or existing culture right now around us, is a whole body experience. It's not something we just do with our eyes or with our thoughts. It's something that our entire being takes in because we have so many sense doors, so many ways of experiencing the world, and we do it in a multi-sensory way. So in my view, we need to be teaching anthropology as the way for us to understand as best we can culture through all of those different senses.
Oh, yeah, I love that. Thank you so much for sharing that story. That's so interesting, and I think it's also really exciting because you just never know when you're going to get that pull either.
Right. You don't. You
know, to something and then where that might lead you later on. Exactly. You know, you probably had no idea.
No idea
like
at all.
So, you know, so clear, like, oh, I'm going to write a book one day and I'm going to be a professor.
Right. No.
You know?
Yeah. Right. It's just I've always loved writing, but it just came together. So that book, you know, had to be written, but I wasn't thinking at the time, of course, of anything like that. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So let's dive definitely a little bit deeper into the book. So the book is called Ethnowise, Embracing Culture Shock to Build Resilience, Responsiveness, and Connection. So first off, I love the title. Tell us a little bit about just an overview of what the book is about. And yeah, let's just start there.
Okay, yeah. It's broken into three parts. And the first part is five principles that I think we all need to understand about being human. And so those five principles come from all different kinds of sciences, not just anthropology. The book is largely an anthropology book, but it's also heavily informed by neuroscience, social psychology, and a little bit of sociology. So some other fields come in there to really flesh out our experience of being human. And I divided it into five principles because as humans, and as especially in our American culture and society, we like to have things kind of laid out for us, you know. Yes. We like to have, okay, what are the five principles, you know, rather than reading and have to dig around to find them yourself, you know. So I figured it would be easier to just come up with five principles, you know. And it's an arbitrary number. There are probably more. There are, but five I think are pretty important. And I won't, you know, belabor it by going to all five. But there's a metaphor. There's a central metaphor around the whole that the book revolves around. The whole concept of the book revolves around, and that comes from a movie at the end of the 20th century, which I actually experienced. I experienced the movie, but I also experienced the end of the 20th century and the middle of it too. I have to date myself, but you know, the movie was The Matrix, and I've talked to students now, and many of them, when I asked them, have you seen that movie? They raised their hands. This is a movie that had a huge impact beyond just being an action thriller or something like that, or sci-fi, dystopian sci-fi action film. It raised some really important questions and also kind of plucked some strings in all of us about the experience of being human. And caused us to ask questions. It was three parts, and the first one I think was the best, and most people I talked to agreed that the first one was the best, and the other two were just kind of add-ons. Yeah. But the first one really put out there some important questions about what it is to be conscious, what it is to be human, and how do we know our reality? How do we know it's what we think it is? And in truth, we can't know, because we have a brain. It's inside our skull. And the brain does not directly experience the world. The brain needs sensors, like a robot would need sensors to be able to process data about its surroundings and have some kind of algorithms in place to make decisions based on the processing, the results of the processing of the data. We do something similar. We're not robots, but we have senses. And without those senses, we can't know what the world is like. But the senses don't give us 100% of what's really going on. There's some really exciting neuroscience research that's gone on that was going on as I was finishing the book, and I learned about later, so in a future edition I might weave it in there. But there's some work that shows that our brain actually is a modeling organ. So it's always coming up with models of the world, a lot like when you look at a globe and it has the different countries of the world on it. How representative is that globe of the actual planet Earth? There's some really accurate stuff, but there's also some stuff that isn't so accurate. It's an approximation. And it's also a lot has lost because, you know, you've got a globe in your hands that's the size of a basketball, and you've got a planet you're standing on that you could never grasp with your hands.
Right.
And so how much is lost in trying to represent the diversity and the richness of what exists on a planet, on a globe. So a lot is lost. But for some of us who need to get around or whatever, we might have a map or a globe or something like that in order to make sense out of the world. And so our brains actually, that's what they're built to do. This is what the new research is showing. They're built to create these models, but the models aren't perfect. And the models are based on, in part, sensory data that's coming in, but they're also based on assumptions our brain makes about the world that are kind of probabilistic. That means that it's making guesses. So, you know, if you only have feeds coming in that are visual, but you can't get the whole visual spectrum, humans see a very narrow range of the visual spectrum. We can't see ultraviolet light and so forth. So our eyes can only record a certain range of a visual spectrum. Hearing, same thing. You can't hear every sound. Elephants can hear subsonic sounds. We can't. So there's a whole bunch of data coming in all the time, but it's not a perfect representation of what's going on in the world. So our brain is working with what we have, and it's constantly coming up with predictive models. And when the model doesn't fit, it adjusts. So what I think is interesting about that, in the movie, you have this idea that the model is actually being constructed by AI, by artificially intelligent overlords who are, you know, really the human beings are in vats having their energy extracted from their bodies, but a fantasy is being created for them by this computer, by this artificial intelligence, and has created a world. And we believe that the world is as we experience it, but it's actually being constructed all the time by the machine, by the program, by the algorithm. And so really, to me, what the point that came home from that was that that's what culture does too. So it actually, our brains are always trying to construct models for how the world is, only to the extent that we can use that information to survive. Our brains aren't interested in building elaborate, complex models of the world that have no bearing on our survival. The brain, you know, if we were doing that, we would need a lot more energy than we have. So they're only concerned with building models that make sense for our survival. Culture is the same thing. It's made up of rules, practices, beliefs, all kinds of things that are only related to our survival. Sometimes when the world changes, culture doesn't change along with it, and so it doesn't fit anymore really well. And that's very similar to what the brain is like. It constructs a model, and if you change your environment, that model doesn't hold up anymore, and the brain has to reconstruct it. So culture creates a matrix for us that our brain uses to understand, to make sense out of all of that data, that incomplete data that's coming in to our awareness. And it's a big player. So when we study cultural anthropology, we learn that in different parts of the world, people with different kinds of heritage, people with different kinds of physical environments, they are operating in a different matrix. And so what they see may not be exactly what I see. What they hear, what they understand from what they hear and touch and taste might be quite different from what I understand. So this is the exciting part of it, but this is the part that that can be confounding too. And so, like I said, when the brain comes up against information that doesn't fit its model, it has to change. But change is not something we're all that good at. And so culture doesn't change very readily. And so our perception of the world doesn't change maybe as readily as it should when we're confronted with new information. And that's where culture shock comes in. So the whole concept of culture shock is really what happens when you come up against something that doesn't fit with your model of the world. And so there's culture shock involved in how our brain has to confront those things and remodel, and there's culture shock in terms of the matrix that's created by culture itself, and how that in itself, instead of helping us survive, sometimes it hinders our understanding of the world because things have changed and it's not able to readily cope with it. So we experience that, as I said at the beginning, as a whole body kind of experience. It isn't just a thought that happens in your head. It's a reaction, a physical reaction that has correlates in the body. So that's, again, why the book is so focused on that kind of holistic approach and teaching us, working with these ideas that we get from other kinds of things like mindfulness science, working with techniques and concepts that come from what some people call critical first person studies, meaning there are ways we can train our own attention to understand our reactions to things. Culture sometimes prevents us from doing that. And these kinds of mindfulness approaches allow us to reconnect with our actual experience in the present moment and give us the opportunity to learn from our experience. So that was a very long-winded answer, but that kind of sums up. That's part one. oh yeah, that's right. There are other parts. So part two is really getting into tools, mindfulness being one of them, but also tools from ethnography, which is the kind of primary toolkit for cultural anthropology. And so it brings up some different concepts and it brings up some different techniques that help us. We can put to work. You don't have to be an anthropologist to put them to work to understand your world better and to connect with other human beings a lot better and learn from your experience. And the third one, the third part really is a small part that's oriented around putting it to work. So you got the tools, you got the principles, you got the tools, and then you got the roadmap at the end for how to make it all come together.
Yeah, I love this. And I think, whenever I just even moved from my small town in Florida to Florida State, which is like a very large town to me. It's not even that big, but the school was huge. And I just remember meeting a ton of different people who were from so many different areas and backgrounds and experiences. Mm-hmm. And for me, that was, you talk about cultural discomfort zone. That was, I definitely see that for me. And then, but then from there, I had opportunities to go travel abroad as well. And just definitely getting outside of my comfort zone.
Mm.
But I think I don't think that I embraced the culture as much as I wanted to looking back.
Mm, absolutely.
And it's something that I want to do more of. How would you suggest using the tools and these principles in practice for students, especially who are, I mean, we almost all are, right? If you're going from one place to another, especially a college environment, you're getting a lot of different types of people typically. So how do we understand and you put this stuff into practice?
Yeah. The first step is to recognize, as you use the term cultural discomfort. And so in the book, I use the term cultural discomfort zone.
Yeah.
So we all hear in kind of regular everyday talk about the idea of comfort zones and stepping out of my comfort zone and stuff like that. So what a cultural discomfort zone is an experience that is not in your culture zone. You've stepped out of it. You're in a place that makes you feel really uncertain. And so the first thing is recognizing when you are in a cultural discomfort zone, because we all tend towards what's called reactivity, meaning that when something hurts, you want to get away from it or you want to get rid of it. And so this is just natural. I mean, part of being a living thing that we don't like pain. So pain can come in so many different forms, right? I mean, there's physical pain, getting pinched or poked or something like that. But also there's emotional pain and psychological pain. And sometimes in some ways, that's even worse. We have, for instance, an epidemic of anxiety these days, especially among students. And that is emotional pain and psychological pain. It has a physical correlate for sure. And so, you know, what does that feel like? And what's causing it? These are important questions to ask. And we ask them of cultural discomfort as well as any other kind of discomfort. And so really the key thing is to recognize when you're experiencing cultural discomfort, which means you're having interactions with people who have quite different ways of seeing the world, quite different value systems, different language, different ways of expressing themselves, different ways of expressing likes and dislikes, everything from their comfort with physical distance. So, you know, somebody in one cultural group might be much more comfortable coming up and talking to me 3 inches from my face than I would be walking up to someone and, you know, I would be much more comfortable talking maybe 2-3 feet from them. That's the way I was raised. That's how I was enculturated. But there are people who are not enculturated that way. They believe that when they're talking to somebody in a honest way, that the best way to do that is to be close. And so, you know, it could be that. It can also be, you know, belief systems. When somebody believes something that is just doesn't make any sense to you, that's cultural discomfort. So it's not like stepping, it's not like putting your hand on a hot stove, but you have a similar reaction. You want to pull away. Or you want to get rid of the thing that's causing you that discomfort. And so first thing is recognizing that that's happening. And that's really difficult because we're so reactive to things. We just, all we're lost in the moment is getting rid of that feeling, getting away from it or getting rid of it. We don't pause to say to ourselves, why am I experiencing this and what's causing it? Wow, I'm in a cultural discomfort zone. We don't do that. And so we just get reactive and we make mistakes as a result. We, you know, lose opportunities to have interesting relationships with people. We lose opportunities to learn something new about the world. We cause cultural discomfort in other people because we are so reactive. All kinds of things happen when we don't recognize that it's happening to us. And the next part is facing it. It's not running away from it. It's experiencing it fully. And there are techniques for how to experience cultural discomfort fully. And to understand that it's not going to kill you, you know? I mean, granted, I could go to a part of the world where my life is in danger for sure. And we have, you know, veterans on our campus who have been in those situations again and again and again. But they themselves also, they take my class and they read my book and find something meaningful in it there too. Because they recognize that there's a difference between a realistic threat somebody actually going to hurt you, and a symbolic threat, meaning that your value system is being challenged. You know, they recognize there's a fundamental difference there, and they want to be able to know the difference, because really for veterans, not just veterans, but for military people in general, their lives sometimes depend on knowing that difference. You don't want to conflate those. You don't want to think that when you're realistically in danger that it's just symbolic. And you also don't want to be thinking that when you're just having your values challenged that your life is threatened. You can make really bad choices as a result of those confusions. Yeah. That's the next step. You know, first you recognize it and then you embrace it. You walk right into it and feel it and know it. And so that's really what the book is designed to do, is help us walk through that, down that path.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I know that we've talked a lot about mindfulness. So I want to talk about, if you wouldn't mind talking about the four ethno-wise tools that you have.
Sure.
So mindfulness meditation, mindfulness awareness, deep hanging out, and deep listening. Like whenever I was looking at these, I was thinking about just how much mindfulness has been profound in my own life, and how much I've enjoyed my life so much more, just being more mindful. And I'm such a amateur at this too. So I would love for you to kind of share a little bit about it. And I also think too, with college students right now, social media is such a big thing that's happening. And even just the other day, on my way to a meeting, and I was running late, and I was like trying to do something on my phone before I got to the meeting. So I'm walking and looking at my phone.
Right.
And then I walked back after the meeting, and I saw so many beautiful flowers. I was like, how did I miss this?
Right.
It was gorgeous. Exactly. I could not believe that I just walked right by it without even noticing it.
That's right.
And so, I mean, just the way that we can just miss experiencing actual like life and actual like connection with people.
That's right.
And it's so easy to do that nowadays. So can you just maybe talk about a little bit about the tools?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. All four of them you could call mindfulness tools. And all four of them you could call anthropological or ethnographic tools, because people who are trained to be professional anthropologists or ethnographers use them. Sometimes they don't know they're using them, but they're using them. The latter two, the deep listening and deep hanging out, those are fundamental to ethnography. So they know when they're doing those. But the mindful part, you know, you don't learn as thoroughly about a cultural experience that you're having if you're not training yourself to be super mindful. And so the first one, you know, mindfulness meditation, is just like training in the gym. If you're training for a marathon, you don't get out there and just run 26.2?
Yep.
Something like that. Miles. You can see I'm not a marathon runner. But, you know, you don't just jump out there and do that. You will really get hurt. And so what you do is you train. And so mindfulness meditation is just simply training. It's some people call it attentional training. Because it turns out our minds are not designed for bringing our attention to things fully, especially in the present moment. Our minds are more designed to ponder the past. And that means, you know, thinking, oh, I should have said that, or, oh, I wish I'd done things differently, or, oh, those were the good old days, whatever it is, you know. We do that very easily. And then also we ruminate about the future, and we think, oh, you know, if I don't get this thing done now, horrible things are going to happen later. Or, you know, you find that depending on the kind of person you are, you might, if somebody gives you a quiet moment, you know, whether it's maybe 60 seconds, you will probably notice what your mind habitually is trained to do. So you might be a person who dwells on the past. You might be a person who constantly, you know, stresses out about the future. You might be a person who's always thinking plan, 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 plan. So given a quiet moment, you might sit there and think, okay, now let's see, 5 minutes from now I have to do this. And then next week I got to get ready for this thing that I got to do, you know? And so you find yourself just habitually revolving around these either past or present, or fantasizing, thinking, you know, I hate my life. I wish I was on a beach, you know, fantasy. But one of the things we don't naturally do without special attentional training is really, really bring our attention to the present moment.
Yeah,
which might be unpleasant or it might be pleasant, but it's what it's the only thing we have. You know, all that future stuff may or may not happen. All the past stuff, guess what? It's done. So really the present is all we have. So we really have to, oddly enough, we have to train ourselves. And I talk in the book about this thing called the default mode network, which is something neuroscientists have found in the brain. It's not a part of the brain. It's an interaction with parts of the brain. And really it's designed for, it's the daydreaming part of our cognition. And so it's the DMN for short, default mode network, it kicks into gear probably most of your day. So you're spending most of your day pondering things, past, future or fantasies, and not really bringing your attention to the present moment. So it's like working out in the gym. When you practice that, the first thing you discover is that you suck at it. That's the first thing you discover, is that, wow, I cannot hold my attention on the present moment for 10 seconds, never mind a minute.
Right.
And so that's the first thing you notice. And then you notice over time with continued practice that it actually improves your attentional capacity, just like training your body. You find improvements. And you backslide and you know, all these kinds of things. And that's perfectly normal. So that's the kind of thing you need to hone those attentional abilities to really pay attention to what's going on in you and around you, if you're really going to make the most of a cultural discomfort zone. And mindful awareness goes hand in hand with that. It's just how we apply that stuff. So it's maybe not the marathon, but it's the short runs you go on every day as part of the training you've been doing in the gym. And then ultimately, you know, you're running a marathon. So it's putting those principles that you've discovered. Really, there's a lot of discovery that's part of that meditation piece about yourself. You're like, oh, I had no idea that I keep looping on these things over and over. I wake up in the morning and I think the same thoughts. That's something that really is astounding, when you realize that you're not quite as original as you thought you were. Your brain actually churns out the same thoughts in certain contexts again and again. It's like a broken record, you know?
Yeah.
So you discover all these things about yourself, and you learn not to take them personally. You learn not to take them, you not to judge them. You learn that it's just part of being human, and that's how our brain works. And, you know, it trains itself to do these things. So mindful awareness is really putting those things to practice and discovering in your interactions with other people that those things are at play, and they have physical correlates, emotional correlates, and cognitive. So then when you get into deep listening and deep hanging out, that's the ethnographic part, where you are actually listening to learn from someone, not listening to think of the next thing you're going to say to them. How many times where you're in a conversation and you're like, well, now I have to pitch something and I'm going to say, you know, and you're spending all your time thinking about what you're going to say next rather than deeply listening to what that person is saying and really trying to understand where they come from. And deep hanging out is that physical full body experience of being there with people and in their cultural context, going, you know, experiencing what they experience and processing it in a way that allows you to learn the most you can from it. And that means being really open and not hiding and not protecting yourself, not being defensive, not trying to take your cultural matrix and impose it on them, but instead to open up to their experience so that you can learn as much as you can from it.
Yeah, and that seems, I think it's really challenging to be vulnerable and authentic already.
Yes.
And then when you are, and then you're put in this very uncomfortable situation. So it's like those.
Yeah. Yes, exactly.
I think too, something I wanted to mention with the training with mindfulness meditation, I think it's so awesome that you said, you know, you don't have to be good at it.
Right.
You know, you're not supposed to know how to do it yet. So you're not going to be good at it at first. And
right.
So to accept that, and that's okay. So I appreciate you telling that to me, because I needed to hear that. But also I hear people, I'll talk about it, like I'm dabbling in this and I'm trying this out, and people are like, oh, really? Yeah, I just thought that'd be so, it's so hard. I'm like, yeah, it is.
It is hard, exactly.
It's supposed to be, but.
Yes, yes, exactly. Like any physical training, you know, we're taught in our culture, in American culture anyway, we're taught about, you know, the importance of physical health, and that we should be working out. Even if we're not, we should be doing some kind of exercise to keep our blood flowing into the right places and maintain muscle tone and all those kinds of things. We know that's a good thing to do, even when we're not doing it. We know that's a good thing to do. But what our culture does not teach us is that our minds need the same kind of care. And so, you know, sure, we have a booming industry in self-help and psychological counseling and things like that, but we ourselves as individuals aren't really trained how to learn that kind of those kinds of skills, and so we end up having to farm it out to specialists because we were never instructed in the first place. And so this has benefits on a lot of levels: the personal level, the psychological level, the interpersonal level, and then of course the intercultural level, which is what the book's about.
Yeah. Well, Just because of time, I feel like sure. I could talk to you about so many other things.
Yeah, well, we could always do a part two at some point.
Yeah. So if you have a student who's reading this book in your class or who just picks it up and starts kind of reading it, what are like one or two things that you hope that they leave that book saying, okay, this is what I really have learned from this?
Yeah. One of the front and center things that I introduce students to in the book, pretty much when you get started, is what I call the ABCs, learning your ABCs. And, you know, for those of us for whom English is a first language, or at least have an alphabet that starts with A and goes B, C, however you might say it, you know, we're familiar with this idea of basics. That means basics. And ABCs actually stand for something. A stands for affect, which in psychology means your emotions, roughly. But also, it can mean your the bodily sensations that are linked to emotions. So really working with that. B is behavior, and that can be speech, and it also can be action. So really paying attention, bringing mindful attention to how you behave as you're reacting to cultural unfamiliarity. And the C is cognition, and that means your thoughts. And so we get to watch those. We get to learn what those feel like and look like to us, and not to pass judgment on them. We have to understand fundamentally, and this is what I want students to leave with, is number one, knowing that we have ABCs and that we can learn them. And two, that we can't take them personally. We can't judge ourselves and say, oh, I had this horrible thought. You know, I'm in a culturally unfamiliar place, and all I can think about is how stupid those people are that I'm dealing with. And really, it's a reactivity. They aren't stupid, of course, but that's how I'm feeling, defensive. Mm-hmm. And so recognizing that I'm not a bad person because I had that thought, but instead watching those thoughts and learning from them and understanding how they are part of our cultural conditioning. They're a defensive maneuver that when we're experiencing a symbolic threat, we have defensive maneuvers and sometimes offensive maneuvers. We might get into the B or behavioral area and start saying mean things to someone because we're trying on some level to protect ourselves because we feel under threat. So those are the things, embracing that spirit, that experience of cultural discomfort, learning those ABCs and learning new things about ourselves without passing judgment on ourselves for experiencing them.
Yeah, it's like you have to put yourself out there and like take action, but then you have to be okay or like learn from it, be aware.
All the time.
Try to be more mindful, yeah.
One of the quotes in the book that I use is from an anthropologist who actually teaches at University of Colorado. And she says, your body is your instrument for knowing. And so you are your instrument. Actually, she shouldn't say body. She says, you are your instrument. And I like that better because the body is part of it, but also how we think. And so our ABCs are part of it. That is our instrument. As I said in the very beginning of our conversation, we use multisensory access to information. We've got to learn to use it. And when you learn to use it, you discover so much more about yourself and about the world that you live in.
Mm, I love that. And that is a perfect place to kind of wrap up.
Beautiful.
So where can people find you if they want to connect with you or purchase your book?
Sure. Well, you can jump online to UNC and find me in the anthropology department for sure. I've got a webpage there.
And that's University of Northern Colorado.
University of Northern Colorado. Yeah. That's the other UNC, right?
Yeah.
If you're on the other side of the Mississippi, you might've been thinking about the North Carolina,
yeah.
But no, I'm talking about Northern Colorado. And another way is you can visit the website for my book, which is called Ethnowise. So it's ethnowise.com. That's where you can read a little bit more about the book itself and find some other things.
Perfect. And I will link all of those in the show notes. So fantastic. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Enjoyed it, Alicia.
I hope that you all enjoyed this episode as much as I did. I have the link to Dr. Michael Kimball's book in the show notes if you would like to check it out. Also, his website is available if you want to learn more about him and what he is working on. I also have a link to the internship that he mentioned with the National Park Services if anyone is interested in doing that one of these summers coming up. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe, share it with a friend, and I hope that you have an excellent week.